Okay, welcome. Welcome to Windows Server 2012, Storage Capabilities for Everybody. I'm Darren Moss. I'm a program manager in the Windows Storage Group. And throughout this session, I'll be covering the enhancements we've made to storage, specifically for enterprise class scenarios. And as you have a question, please feel free to raise your hand. And I don't see any microphones in the room, so it might be pretty hard to hear your question. So if you'd prefer, you can wait until the end of the presentation, then come up to the front. And I'll remain here afterwards so that you can ask your questions and I can answer them. And I will be reserving about 15 minutes at the end of the, 15 minutes of the end of the session time specifically to be able to answer questions right here in the room. So my group, the Storage and File Systems Group, is responsible for all the platform storage features which ship in all Windows versions. What we have done with Server 2012 is innovate across a wide multitude of scenarios. We've maximized availability, we've minimized operational expenses, minimized capital expenses, and maximized the value that you get out of existing hardware. That's what you see on the left-hand side of the screen there. And on the right-hand side, I have a list of the features that we've developed that you will get to use in order to achieve these things, minimizing CapEx, minimizing OpEx, and so forth. And as we look at storage, we have the traditional way that you deploy storage. An external storage subsystem that's very capable, attached to Windows servers through some kind of, usually a storage area network, typically Fibre Channel, iSCSI. And there, once you've attached your storage to Windows, you have both the opportunity to run your workloads locally, and that's what you see in the upper right-hand corner of this matrix. Your storage subsystem is attached to the app servers, and the app servers just use local file access to get to their data. Or you can use file shares on the servers that are connected to the storage, and you can access your files remotely. And that's what you see in the lower right-hand corner of this matrix. Separate file servers, separate app servers. So that's the traditional approach. And we've made enhancements to make that traditional approach even better with Server 2012. We've also introduced a new category of deployments, some cost-efficient deployments. And that's what you see in the left-hand column there, where you can just take JBODs, just a bunch of disks, a very simple drive array, and directly connect that to Windows through a SAS connection. And then again, the same options. You can use local file access, run your apps on the same machines connected to your storage, or you can use remote file access, have a separate set of servers running your apps, accessing their data through a file share. So we've innovated in both categories, brought new capabilities into Windows in both, and I'll be covering what capabilities are there for you to take advantage of. The end goal that we have with all these enhancements that we've put into Server 2012 is to make Server 2012 the most cost-efficient platform for continuous availability and high scalability. So the first feature that I'd like to talk about is storage spaces. Storage spaces enables that left-hand column, the new type of storage deployment where you directly attach storage to Windows. Our goal there, and the thing I'd like to impress upon you today, is that using storage spaces, you'll be able to achieve lower price points and achieve maximized operational simplicity. So first off, let's talk a little bit about directly attached storage. So here on this slide, I have a few JBODs, just very simple drive arrays, pictured across the bottom there. They should look fairly familiar to you. In one case, I have a 60-bay JBOD, which is pretty new on the market. But in other cases, I have 24-bay JBODs there. They look like regular drive arrays. And in most cases, they'll look like and feel like regular drive arrays. They have drives that you slide into the front. You can hot unplug them, hot plug them. And on the back side, they have SaaS connectivity. And for enterprises, SaaS is the type of connectivity that we recommend because Windows scales from the consumer laptops all the way up to the big data center machines. We also support connecting storage through USB and SATA. Given we are covering Server 2012, we'll be focusing on using SAS connected storage. Now, once you have this storage directly attached to Windows, we have given you two new powerful concepts, abstractions, to the platform. The first is a concept of a pool. So if you connect 3 or 4 or 5 of these 24-bay JBODs, or even a couple of these 60-bay JBODs, you very quickly have hundreds of disks directly attached to Windows. We help you manage that by introducing the concept of a storage pool. A storage pool basically allows you to aggregate storage together and use that pool as a unit of management, a unit of isolation. Once you have that capacity aggregated together in a pool, we give you the ability to carve out of that capacity what we call storage spaces. These are logical disks. They give you the ability to define a certain type of resiliency. So one storage space, you could define to have a two-way mirror, and that would give you tolerance for one drive failure. And another storage space, you could define to have a three-way mirroring, and that gives you tolerance for two drive failures. So out of the same pool, you're able to use the capacity of that pool in different ways depending on the needs of your data. So conceptually, still taking a little high-level view here, conceptually, storage spaces, it's a logical disk, and so to the rest of Windows, your logical disk looks like and feels like and acts like just about any other kind of disk you have. And that means you can use SMB with it, Hyper-V, you can use any enterprise-class file system we have, REFS, NTFS, you can use failover clustering, CSV, and so forth. Now, directly attached storage with SAS gives you two options. One, if you don't need the high availability or have some other approach for maintaining availability, you can take what you see on the left-hand side here, a standalone server, and just attach your storage directly to that. Or if you use Windows Failover Cluster to achieve high availability, then you can directly attach your storage to multiple servers. In this case, I'm showing 4 JBODs, which support directly attaching 3 servers. Now, once you have attached all that storage to Windows, and you've put all those disks into pools and have them manageable, you have opened up your Windows platform to a powerful set of capabilities. Flexible provisioning, resiliency for drive failures, multi-tenancy, high availability, high scalability, and the ability to optimize your workload performance based on the type of media those workloads need. You can mix SSDs, different speed hard drives, all in the same pool, and have those disks used specifically for the workload that need those characteristics. And I'll cover all these in detail in the next few slides. So first, the flexible provisioning. With storage spaces, we give you the ability to use thin provisioning. And what that means is you can look forward to what size your data might grow to, or if you don't know what size it might grow to eventually, you can just pick a very large size. And in this example, I'm showing 60 terabyte storage spaces. And that can be well beyond the capacity that your pool has at that point in time. But because of thin provisioning, your storage spaces don't actually allocate any of that capacity until it has data that needs to be stored. So you can start with a small pool. In this example, I gave 36 terabytes with a bunch of 60 terabyte spaces across two pools and just let that data keep growing up until the point where I needed to add more disks. And then, here I had a truck backing up with another JBOD of disks. I increased the total capacity in my deployment there to 48 terabytes. And then added those disks to whichever pools needed more capacity. But we not only give you the flexibility to add capacity as your data sets grow, we also give you the ability to reclaim capacity as your data sets change. So this happens through what we call the trim and the unmap commands. These are industry standard commands that we have worked with the storage vendors to define. And what they allow you to do is, as files are deleted, the file systems, NTFS and REFS, generate these unmap and trim commands, send them down to the storage. And in this case, Storage Spaces receives those commands, understands that capacity is no longer in use, and returns it back to the pool. Now another storage space, as it takes on more data, is able to go and use that capacity. But it's not only applicable to deleted files, but you could have subsections of a file which is no longer in use. The thing to think about there is VHDs. VHDs look like a disk to the virtual machines that are running inside of them. So when a file is deleted inside of a VHD, that's really just a subsection of the VHD which is no longer in use. And we support that as well. You can have file deletion within a VHD, and that will go down all the way to the underlying storage spaces, and that capacity will be reclaimed. And then beyond that, we have a scheduled optimizer built into Windows, which will kick in on a regular basis, analyze the layout of your files, peer all the way down to storage spaces, see how the allocations are spread across your pool, and then optimize the file layout to keep the amount of capacity in your pool in use very close to the amount of data actually stored. Resiliency. So there are two types of resiliency that we offer with storage spaces. The first I'd like to touch on is power faults, another type of hardware events which cause a server to go through a boot cycle. So we have mirror spaces and parity spaces. These two types of spaces allow you to tolerate drive failure. When you use these types of spaces, you also get tolerance for, or you get the ability to deal with power faults. With mirror spaces, we have a technology called dirty region tracking. So in the event of one of these types of hardware failures, when the hardware comes back online, or if you use failover cluster, when the other cluster node picks up your storage spaces, you can immediately bring that storage space online. There is no delay. We then use our dirty region tracking to understand which regions of the storage space actually had data in flight in the moment of the failure. And then even while the storage space is online, you're accessing your data and your workloads keep running, we're able to go to those regions and bring them back into a consistent state. With parity spaces, we have a technology that we call integrated journaling. What that technology allows you to do is, or just does automatically, is when a parity space is on a machine which has some kind of hardware failure and another cluster node or the server goes through a reboot, when that storage space comes back online, it's immediate. There is no offline time. The integrated journaling allows Windows to just pick up writing exactly where it left off. No offline time whatsoever. Now, besides having the dirty region tracking, the integrated journaling to help with availability, we have support for hot spares. So when a drive fails, your data will remain accessible and online because you're using mirror spaces or parity spaces. Because you have a hot spare, Windows will immediately kick that in and start using it to repair your storage spaces. But now if you think about the size of disks today, we're currently at 3 terabytes. And there's no signs of that stopping. We can envision having 4 terabytes and 5 terabytes and even greater disks in the future. But historically, even as disk capacities have increased, the pipe, the bandwidth available to get data into and out of those disks has not increased as rapidly. So to assist in quickly rebuilding disks which have hosted terabytes of data before they failed, we not only bring in a hot spare to add more capacity to the pool, but we also use spare capacity throughout the pool. And that allows us to rebuild more quickly as we have more I/O available for servicing repair operations. Now, the simplicity. There are two things to think about here. The first is enclosure awareness. And when you have 2 or 3 or 4 JBODs in your system, you have the opportunity to spread your mirrors across two or three JBODs, or as many JBODs as you have. What that enables you to endure is an entire array failure. You could have one drive array lose connectivity, lose power, or what have you, go through some kind of failure, but because of enclosure awareness, you can have one half of your mirror on one JBOD, which has remained, and the other half of your mirror on another JBOD, which has incurred this failure. So even with an entire drive array failure, enclosure awareness tells you that data is still going to be accessible. It's something that happens automatically as soon as you enable enclosure awareness and just makes it very simple to get increased levels of resiliency in your deployments. But not only that, with storage spaces, we've integrated with the Windows security model. What that means is you can define non-admin users and give them some administrative capability. So in this example, I have a hoster admin, and this can be the all-powerful admin that has privileges to do everything. And this hoster admin can then create multiple pools and define for those pools a user and set an ACL on those pools that says this user can do things to this pool, such as create spaces, delete spaces, change the pool name, change the name of the spaces, that sort of thing. And then I call that the tenant admin in this example. And because of the isolation that the pools give you, you can have two different customers, whether they're inside the same company or working for separate companies. You can have two sets of customers using two different pools, and you don't have to worry about the management actions of one customer interfering with the management actions of another. Now, this delegation of administration extends beyond just the pool. The tenant admin can go into their pool, and for each space, they can define another ACL and create a tenant admin, a workload admin. And this workload admin, especially when you have a virtualized deployment, this workload admin can do many things, such as partition the disk, reformat the disk, delete the partitions, that sort of thing. So it gives you this ability to offer self-service capability to your customers. Now, there are a variety of types of disks in the market. You have SSDs, you have high-speed hard drives, you have capacity-optimized hard drives, and all those disks exist in the market for a reason. They provide certain characteristics which are better given, which are geared for specific scenarios. In this example, I have SSDs, which I call my gold storage, providing storage for a finance database and an ERP database. Just because these SSDs are unique relative to hard drives, that doesn't mean they have to be in a separate pool. You can put them in the same pool. You can apply the same ACL to just that one pool and not have multiple pools to make sure that the ACL remains in sync. And also in this example, I have 15K RPM disks, higher performance hard drives. But again, you can say just this space or just this set of spaces can use those disks. And in this case, I call that my silver set of disks. In this example, I show you one home space, and there I just have some user documents. And then finally, you can keep going, three classes and four classes and five classes of storage. In this case, I just stopped at three and said, okay, I have some capacity-optimized disks here. They exist to provide archive storage. And you can keep going from there and in one pool, or you can use multiple pools if you like, but if you prefer one pool and have that one point of management, you can tailor your deployments to have these spaces can be on these disks, different spaces which need different characteristics can be on different spaces. Different disks. So now let's come back to the deployment models. So storage spaces, given the diversity that exists in data centers and the diversity that exists among customers, supports the simplest of deployments up to the most advanced, most capable deployments. So a simple standalone server is a valid deployment with storage spaces, fully supported, and you don't have to compromise on other features such as being able to virtualize your workloads and use them with storage spaces. This is the sort of deployment that we recommend when you can accept periods of downtime for planned maintenance. And let's take a moment and think about performance. With storage spaces, you have the ability to directly attach storage right into Windows. There's nothing in between your disks and Windows to affect your ability to fully utilize the performance capabilities of your storage. So what I'm showing here is a blue bar and a green bar as we scale up the number of disks. The blue bar represents the native storage performance power of those disks. The green bar represents the capabilities of storage spaces being layered on top of those disks. So as you look at this, you can see, given different workload characteristics, sequential reads, sequential writes, random reads, random writes, you can see that the throughput and the IOPS that are achievable with storage spaces very closely matches what's achievable with the disks and scales up nicely with those disks. The message I'm giving here is that storage spaces gives you the ability to fully utilize the performance capabilities of your storage. And I'd like to show you just how powerful that can become. Oh, excuse me, wrong machine. By going to a live demo here. So I'm going to start a performance test. It takes a bit of time, so we'll come back to it. But this performance test is going to do random I/O measurements and sequential I/O measurements. And I'll describe that in detail when we come back and look at the results. So moving on to deployments which have high availability, this should look very familiar to what the standalone is. You can use the exact same JBODs, SAS, but now you just attach multiple servers to those SAS drive arrays. In this case, I have, in this example, I have hardware from RAID Inc., storage hardware from RAID Inc., which directly supports 6 servers attached to it. I've taken 2 of the SAS connections per JBOD and attached 1 server by those 2 SAS links to the JBODs. So that gives me, for each JBOD there, that gives me 6 SAS cables to the JBOD, from the servers to the JBOD. Each SAS cable is capable of 24 gigabits a second. That's a massive amount of performance. 6 SAS cables, 24 gigabits each. In this failover cluster deployment, I'm showing you here in this example the concept of a deployment element. You can look at the storage requirements you have, pick the right kind of storage for it. You can look at the compute requirements you have, pick the right set of servers for that, attach them together, and make that a unit of scale. In this case, we call it, for storage spaces, deployment element. And make that your cluster, carve out storage spaces from it, layer CSV, cluster shared volumes, on top of that to give you a nice uniform namespace across all your cluster nodes, and then run your workloads on top of that. In this case, I'm showing virtualized workloads. And when you do this, you don't lose any of the capabilities that you get with Server 2012, such as live migration and the ability to keep growing your cluster by adding more of these deployable elements. So looking at what that really means as you grow your cluster deployment, I have here in this representation that same deployment element now deployed 3 times in the same cluster. And so as you look at this, you can see that deployment element. And what I'd like to impress upon you is that the 3 JBODs, if you look at just one deployment element, those 3 JBODs are directly attached to those 3 servers. But they're not attached to any of the other servers in the cluster. The other sets of 3 servers in the cluster have their own set of 3 JBODs. So I've taken what I defined as my deployment element, and as my compute needs and my storage needs increased, I've just deployed that same unit of scale multiple times. And using a high-performance cluster network, I'm able to have my storage spaces in their individual pools manifest up to the rest of the cluster. Layering CSV on top of that means the entire cluster can see all the storage which exists in the cluster, and your workloads can run anywhere in the cluster. For example, if SQL has its data stored in the JBODs on the far right, but is executing on the servers on the far left, that's not a problem. CSV says, I know where your data exists. You're running on these machines. I'll redirect your read and write requests over to the servers which are connected to that storage, and you'll still get to read and write your data. Using a high-performance cluster network means that's going to run very fast for you. So here's a real-world example of a cluster deployment element. In this case, I took four servers from RAID Inc. Plus a 60-bay JBOD from RAID Inc., put 3 terabyte disks in it, and got in one cluster deployment element 180 terabytes. This is a capacity-optimized deployment, and using this as my unit of scale, as my compute and storage needs increase, I can just redeploy this multiple times. This hardware is actually here in the Technical Learning Center, and if you'd like to see it and get a better feel for what it's capable of, please come by. I'll be there tomorrow, and I can show you what we have. This is a performance-optimized deployment. In this case, I took a 24-bay JBOD, populated it with SSDs, and then directly connected 3 RAID Inc. servers. This is, again, hardware from RAID Inc. And the thing I'd really like to press upon you here is that this JBOD directly supports 6 SAS cables. I've used 2 SAS cables per server, which gives me 3 servers attached to this JBOD. 6 SAS cables by 24 gigabits. That really allows that massive storage performance available to me in these SSDs to get all the way up into Windows. So we regularly hit well over 1 million IOPS and over 10 gigabytes a second with this type of deployment. It's here at the Technical Learning Center at the storage booth. You can come by and look at it. But this is also the platform that I just started that performance run on. That performance run will be done by now, and so we can look at it, and you can see firsthand just switched the wrong machine again. Just how amazing that is. So here you can see 3 green lines, 3 lines of green text that shows you the results from every node of that cluster, and then the aggregate in red text on a block green line, 1.486 million IOPS. Excuse me? Let's see. Maybe we can increase the font size. Let's try that. Is that better? All right. So here you can see 1.48 million IOPS, random I.O. performance out of those SSDs, and sequential I.O. capability of 10.9 gigabytes a second. That's the benefit you can get when you directly attach storage to Windows and use multiple SAS cables to get all that raw storage performance directly into Windows. Nothing in between slowing it down. And that was run on this exact hardware. You can see it again live at our storage booth. So I've shown you individual cluster deployment elements, but cluster can go all the way out to 64 nodes. And you can go that far, you can go to that level of scale with storage spaces. And we actually test that in our own labs. So here I have a representation of our 64-node cluster. We defined 4 servers per deployment element and then deployed that 16 times to get our 64 cluster nodes. In total, we have over 240 hard drives and SSDs in this configuration and have 4,000 virtual machines running on this test deployment. So with storage spaces, you can go from the simplest of deployments, standalone server, all the way up to the ultimate scale and performance capable with Windows. So here is the message I would like to impress upon you today. Storage Spaces gives you the ability to reach dramatically lower price points using directly attached storage and can drive your operations incredibly down with simple deployments and simple management. Also in the category of enabling new types of deployments, we have REFS. REFS stands for Resilient File System. It's the next generation file system built into Windows and provides us new levels of scale, availability, and cost efficiency. Those are the three things I hope to hope you're able to glean from my message today. We achieve those things through three categories of features: increased data integrity, increased scalability, and increased availability. Also, REFS, being the new file system, builds upon the 20-plus years of NTFS's success and is the natural architectural evolution of NTFS. So first, data integrity. So REFS does two things for you to ensure increased levels of data integrity. First, it gives you the option to allocate on write, which means new data lands in new capacity. And you completely avoid all the issues that arise from in-place updates of data. You also have the option for checksums. So when you write data, REFS will also attach that write a checksum. And so later, when you come back to read that data, REFS is able to compare the read data to the checksum to discover if there have any, if any issues have arisen. And by that, discover whether the data is in a valid state or in a corrupt state. Now, REFS always does these two things for its own metadata to ensure that the file system remains as consistent as possible, but it offers to you the flexibility to turn it on a per-volume basis, a per-directory basis, or even on a per-individual file basis. Now, having the checksums to detect data corruptions is nice. But when you use REFS on top of Storage Spaces, you get even more. But before I talk about what you can achieve with REFS on Storage Spaces, let me first touch on running NTFS on top of Storage Spaces. With NTFS on top of Storage Spaces, we have a regularly running scrubber that comes along, looks at the contents of your storage spaces. When it discovers read failures, the scrubber is able to retrieve the alternate copy of the data and write that down to the disk that had the read failure. So you get phenomenal value of running NTFS on top of storage spaces. You get all of that when you use REFS on top of storage spaces, plus a little more. Because REFS gives you the option to have checksums on your data, the scrubber can go even further than that. When it comes along and it gets read failures, it does the same thing, retrieves the other copies, writes it down to fix that read failure, but occasionally drives will succeed a read with corrupt data. Because you have the checksum, you get the comparison, and the corruption is detected. And in that case, the scrubber can check the other copies, and if the other copies check out that they compare with their checksum, it can use that valid data to overwrite the corrupt data and just automatically fix those issues for you. So phenomenal value when you run REFS on top of storage spaces. But we don't even stop there. REFS can perform that same automatic corruption detection and fix on the fly. In this example, I showed you two disks, a mirror storage space, which has half of its mirror on one disk, half on the other. One copy was good, the other copy was bad. That was the black and white picture. REFS detected that when the application went to access the file, picked up the good copy, replaced the bad copy with the good copy. And this is something that we can watch live. Oops. I need just to be able to switch to this demo machine. There we go. Okay, first, I'll pick up a file on a non-RFS volume. Here we're looking at the first sector of the file, and we can look at it. It's just a JPEG, so it's easy to look at. So here we have a nice scenic photo. Imagine this is from your honeymoon or some once-in-a-lifetime event. An irreplaceable memory, something of great value. So now, what can happen, because it's not a perfect world, corruption can happen. Here, that first sector got overwritten with too bad, too bad. When you go to view that file, what's going to happen? It's gone. That one sector, that one little corruption has made that entire picture unavailable to you now. Hopefully you have a backup. RFS goes one step further than that. It uses that, uses storage space's mirror, the two or three copies, plus its checksums to correct that issue. And I will show you that live here. So here we have the same file, same data. We can look at that same photo. Here it is, the irreplaceable memory, the high value data. And now the corruption. Same corruption, but this is RFS. So when you go to look at that file, RFS says, I have a checksum. That data is corrupt. I know it's corrupt. I'll go to storage spaces. I'll get that second copy. That second copy was good. I'll give that second copy to the app. And I'll send down that good copy to the first copy and get it all fixed up. So that's the value of storage spaces with RFS for you. Now, if we go and read that first sector again, we see that too bad, too bad, too bad. All that corruption, it's all gone. Here's the fixed data. Yes, we have a question out here. So your question is, how did we write to the file without what? Oh, how did we write to the file without updating the checksum? Well, we were very devious. We went under the covers, underneath the file system, directly hit the disks to cause that corruption. So we bypassed all of that. And if you think about what happens in real life, that is often how corruptions can enter the system. The media itself could have issues. The disks themselves can have issues. The cabling can have issues. And, of course, each one of these systems do their best to protect against it, but corruption still happens. It's just a fact of life. That's another question. So the question is, does RFS keep a record of corruptions, sectors that have corruptions? So when you run the scrubber, that does give you a logging of sectors which were automatically corrected for you. On the fly corrections, I believe, get recorded in that same log, but I'm not sure. That's a question I'd have to take back to the development team with me. That's the second question here. So the question is, if you use RFS with parity storage space, what does RFS do? Is that correct? Okay, so with the current release, you get that automatic correction when you use mirror spaces. It's not yet enabled for parity spaces. So you need, if you want that, and I would think most of us do, mirror spaces. Yes? So your question is, RFS is running on a mirror storage space. Okay. And the way RFS was able to automatically recover is because it was able to go to the second copy, which is on a second disk, retrieve the good copy there, use that to fix up the bad copy, and send the good copy up to the application. So your question is, I was able to successfully write, but then how is the mirror not the same? So this is a very devious application. It went all the way down to the physical disks, picked one of the physical disks, corrupted it, and left the other physical disk intact. And that's how I was able to get one copy is corrupted, the other copy is good. It should not be normal whatsoever. But the drives are independent of each other. And so being independent, they're able to take on corruption separate from one another. If the corruption happens higher up, like at the application level, that's when you get the case of the application had a corruption in it, it sent that corruption all the way down. But when the corruptions arise on the media or in transit to the media, that's when you can get the two copies out of sync. And these issues actually occur in the field. And that is the rationale for having gone and built the capability to retrieve the second or the third copy, check it for correctness, and then use that correct copy to fix the bad copy. So RFS not only takes integrity to a new level, not achievable up until now with Windows, but RFS also takes scalability up to a new level. And it achieves high scalability through two approaches. The first is through what are called B+ trees. What that means is it gives you the ability to go from just a few files to many, many files in a volume. B+ trees make that efficient. RFS also has a hierarchy of capacity allocators. And what that means is you have the ability to go from small files, because we have a small file allocator, which is optimized for the small files, to medium-sized files, because we have a capacity allocator optimized for that, to very, very large files, because we have a capacity allocator designed for that. So it gives you scalability on those two fronts. Very few files in a volume to numerous files in a volume. Very small files in a volume to very, very large files in a volume. Those two things in combination give you scalability into the petabytes of capacity, well beyond where you can take NTFS today. And availability. Now, usually when we talk about availability, we're thinking of failover clusters. But even when your failover cluster is running perfectly fine, you can still end up with availability issues when a file system has to go offline for check disk. With RFS, we took the analysis work that check disk does and the repair operations that check disk does and integrated them into the file system. So RFS, while the file system is online and data is being accessed, is able to perform its analysis, perform its repair operation. Now, in this example, I'm again using a mirror storage space where one copy of the metadata has become corrupt. RFS detects that, goes to the other copy of the metadata, picks it up, replaces it, and right there, without any offline time, it was able to analyze the failure and perform a repair operation. Now, RFS, being an architectural evolution, also has the need to think about compatibility. Building on more than 20 years of NTFS deployments, we were careful to retain as much compatibility as possible. And that's what I'm illustrating in this diagram at the bottom. On the left-hand side, you see NTFS. On the right-hand side, you see RFS. With RFS, we took that upper API layer, the way applications interact with the file system, and largely left it intact and unchanged with RFS. So applications essentially work in the same way with RFS that they have with NTFS. Where we focused all the innovation is in the lower layer, the way data and metadata gets laid out on media. And that's what I'm showing at the bottom of this diagram. NTFS has one way that it stores the data and metadata on media. RFS has another way. And that's from the way RFS lays out data and metadata is where you get the increased integrity, the increased scalability, and the increased availability. Now, while we have largely retained that upper API layer, there are a few things that you have to be aware of. So there are legacy features in NTFS which don't make any sense to carry forward. These are things like short names and TXF. Those aren't in REFS. There are things which are very specific to the way NTFS lays out data and metadata on the media. These are things like reparse index, name streams, and the master file table. So NTFS-specific things aren't carried forward. Now, I'll skip the category called other for a moment and talk about the superseded. NTFS has been around for a very long time. It has EFS, the encrypting file system, built into it. It has quotas built into it. It has compression built into it. Over those 20 years, we've had other solutions come out. For example, now BitLocker is available, which not only encrypts files, but also encrypts all the metadata as well. So we look at that and say, BitLocker has superseded NTFS's encrypting file system. Same with quotas. There's now the file system quota, which is available as a file system filter. Same with compression. There's now deduplication, which is able to give you capacity optimization well beyond where compression has ever been able to go. So we look at those things and say, NTF has them. They're great. But now, in today's world, we have even better solutions available for us. So in REFS, you won't find native encryption, quotas, or compression. Now this category I skipped called other. There are a certain set of features which are not yet available in REFS. With the Server 2012 release, we looked at the types of scenarios we first wanted to introduce REFS into and built the things which were essential for those scenarios. That means REFS doesn't do everything that we envision it eventually can do. So there are certain things such as hard links, extended attributes, and object IDs which are not there in REFS. Some applications have taken dependencies on these things and will not yet be able to run on REFS. So as you look at getting the advantage of REFS in your data center, you will want to take the applications that you run and try them against REFS to discover if they've taken dependencies on some of these things which REFS does not yet have. So I was just talking about having targeted REFS for certain deployments, and you might wonder, well, where do we envision REFS being used? What have we designed it for? And that's what I'm giving you an example of here. I have a two-node cluster with some storage directly attached to it. Storage spaces is being used to take all those disks, pull them together, and give you some mirror spaces. On these mirror spaces, I have different types of volumes, one for the marketing department, home directory, VHD library, and on top of that, I've created file shares. So as a file server, REFS is great. REFS is great. You can use it as VHD library, home directory, user directories, and so forth. Things where you need to make sure your data remains safe and unaffected by media failures and media corruptions. Wherever you want to have that high availability, that high data integrity. So here's what I've liked to have impressed upon you. With REFS, you can achieve availability, data integrity, scalability, and cost efficiency, which has not been available native to Windows until now. So if you think back to one of my first slides, I had a matrix of four types of deployments. We have just talked about storage spaces and REFS, which largely help that new category, that cost-efficient category, where you directly attach storage to Windows. Now, thinking about traditional storage deployments, we still have NTFS. It's still an enterprise-class file system. It's still an enterprise-class file system and still applicable to a broad, broad set of scenarios. So we've continued to innovate on NTFS to make it even better for enterprises. So given the improvements we made to NTFS and CheckDisk, we are delivering the ability to confidently deploy multi-terabyte volumes. What does that mean? What does CheckDisk have to do with multi-terabyte volumes? Well, what can impair using NTFS on multi-terabyte volumes is dealing with inconsistencies, corruptions that arise on media. When that happens in the current model, you have to take the volume offline and run CheckDisk. And depending on the nature of the corruption, CheckDisk could take a very long time to complete its analysis phase and then finally perform its repair operation. So to make availability and TFS availability reach new heights well beyond where it is today, we have split check disk into two pieces, analysis phase and repair phase. What that means is analysis can now happen online. So NTFS can, while it's running, it can detect that there's a corruption. Now, in some cases, NTFS is able to identify the corruption, the nature of the corruption, and just fix it in place. In other cases, it has to actually run an analysis, a true analysis phase, to understand the nature of the corruption and know what repair operation to take. That analysis happens online. And so finally, when analysis is complete, you then have the option to choose when you take the volume offline, take it offline, use CheckDisk to perform the repair operation, which at that time, given all the analysis is complete, will be very quick. And then the volume comes back online. So you have a very, very brief downtime. And this is what I'm talking about. Very brief. With releases of Windows until now, because analysis happens online, or excuse me, offline, when you have, say, 300 million files, you're looking at hours of offline time in order to discover, characterize, and then understand what repair operation to perform. With the new check disk model, because in many, many cases, the analysis can be performed entirely online, by the time you take NTFS offline, what needs to be done is precisely known. Check disk comes in, fixes it, and you can go right back online. In this example, 0.13 of a minute, so seconds. In seconds, repair is complete, your volume comes back online. Phenomenal improvement. Taking NTFS to levels of availability, which has not been possible till now. Given that, we say you can confidently deploy multi-terabyte volumes with NTFS. Again, thinking about that right-hand side, the traditional storage deployments, particularly thinking about SAN attached storage, fiber channel iSCSI, we have integrated to make management of that storage easier and more uniform. We've integrated into Windows support for an industry management standard called SMIS. We've developed new PowerShell commands that provide storage management and allow you to manage your storage regardless of what type of storage you have in very, very similar ways, often with the exact same commands. So what I'd like for you to gain from this section of this presentation is that with Windows integrating storage management into PowerShell, you get that integrated experience, you get the intuitive nature of PowerShell, you get a lot of power, a lot of flexibility because of PowerShell, and bringing multiple vendors under one management roof, you get some operational simplicity. So not only do we have PowerShell for administrators to manage storage in very, very similar ways, but we also have support for WMI, which means application developers making management tools are able to use one set of WMI classes, a common API set, to manage many things about the diverse set of storage vendors' hardware. And one example of using this WMI-based management for storage is SCVMM. So the next version of SCVMM is going to use this WMI layer for storage management to manage the diverse set of storage in your data centers. Besides SCVMM, an application for Microsoft, we have built into Windows the File Server Manager called File and Storage Services. It's installed by default. It's a management application that uses our WMI layer to manage whatever type of storage you have attached. Now, this is an example of how comprehensive this can be. Storage Spaces is built into Windows. It's native to Windows. It just uses that PowerShell and WMI storage management layer. And that's what I'm showing in that green bar, is that management layer. An SMIS-compliant subsystem, a storage subsystem which has been updated to the latest standards, will just work. Windows natively supports SMIS. You can attach that and PowerShell, File and Services Manager, and eventually SCVMM will also be able to manage that. Now, we understand not every vendor can comply with SMIS or has the right type of hardware for SMIS. So we've also introduced what we call SMP. It's a storage management provider. We give them the ability to use their own proprietary management protocol, but then install a little binary into Windows and bring that protocol management right into the same WMI, the same PowerShell. And so what I'm talking about there is realized in this example. Here I have three storage subsystems. One is Storage Spaces, native into Windows, just works with our PowerShell and our WMI. The other is an SMIS compliance storage subsystem. This one is from EMC. And then the third is an SMP-based subsystem. In this case, it's from Equalogic. Each three of these subsystems are being managed through one PowerShell. In this example, I have this single PowerShell command called get virtual disk, and there you see those three subsystems are listing out their virtual disks, one from Equalogic, one from Storage Spaces, one from EMC. Three different things, all under one management roof. So what we are really going for is that reduced operational complexity, integrated into Windows and intuitive. Now, the external storage subsystems, which are common when you have a traditional storage deployment, SAN attached storage, has capabilities which we have driven the industry to standardize through standardized specifications, specifically thin provisioning and offloaded data transfers. We have driven standardization of these things to achieve better integrated management, efficient data transfers, optimized capacity utilization. So first, let's think about thin provisioning. So by getting the manifestation of thinly provisioned virtual disks standardized, we've now given Windows the ability to identify disks which are thinly provisioned and use those same things I described about storage spaces, use those same things for external storage subsystems. So as files get deleted, we're able to send these unmapped commands all the way down to the storage subsystem so they can reclaim that capacity, add it back to the pool, and let other virtual disks use it. As our scheduled optimizer comes around, it's able to peer all the way into that storage subsystem, look at how the storage allocations are laid out, come back up to the file system, and optimize the placement of files to keep the amount of capacity allocated as close to the amount of the data as, stored as possible. And this is something which just works automatically. When you have Server 2012 and when you have an external storage system which is updated to the latest standards, you just get this for free. So here is a diagram of what I was just describing. Even inside a virtual machine, you can have a file deletion, and the whole Windows stack understands this file deletion and this unmap command. So the file deletion happens inside the virtual machine. Hyper-V converts that to a subregion of the VHD file. The file system converts that to a region of the volume, and so forth, going down the stack until we have delivered this unmap command to the storage subsystem. In this case, I'm showing with a storage space, which is thinly provisioned. That's why there's a lot of empty space inside that storage space, and then the capacity gets reclaimed by the pool. Now switching to the offloaded data transfers. Now, in today's world, we operate many times with files which are not just gigabytes in size, but hundreds of gigabytes in size. As VHDs have become very common, we've had to also deal with moving those VHDs around. The traditional approach to moving files has worked very well and continues to work well. You use simple commands, well-understood commands, which have well-defined semantics to read the data out of your storage into Windows. Often you'll transfer that data across an Ethernet to another server, which then writes that data to its own storage. Sometimes that storage is in the exact same array as the source. Sometimes it's in another array, which is connected through some back-end storage network to each other. Well, that's been fine, but there is opportunity for making these very large files transfers much, much more efficient. And where the opportunity exists is a reduction of CPU cycles on those two servers, reduction in network bandwidth utilization, and increasing performance. So what do we do? How do we offload these file copies, these data transfers, to the array themselves and to their back-end storage network? Well, we continue to use very similar semantics to keep it a very straightforward and very easy for us, very easy for the servers. The way we make it easy for the servers is by allowing them to still deliver the same type of read command, you know, read from this location, and the array now has the option to return back a token, which is a very small package, instead of gigabytes upon gigabytes upon gigabytes of data. Windows is able to take that token, apply the same security model as it does for real data, transfer that token, again a small package across the network, efficient utilization of that bandwidth, to a different server, and it's able to take that token and transfer it down to the array using the same type of write semantics, or very similar to the write semantics which are in use today. Again, applying that same security model, the same checks. The array then, given the token, can go to the reference storage and transfer that data straight across using the back-end storage network, or if it's actually in the same array, can do something even more efficient than transferring on the back-end storage network. Some vendors are even able to make that very instantaneous. So I would like to show you what this looks like, even when you have to actually move the data on the back-end network. Okay, here we go. Oh, looks like I've been timed out. Let me just log back in. So here I have a single server system which has two file shares on separate arrays. These two arrays are connected by a back-end storage network, and so when I do a file copy, we'll see that even though I'm going over a remote link, I'm RASed all the way back into Redmond in the United States, I'm not going at the kilobits per second that you would expect over such a remote or such a long-distance network connection. I'm running at hundreds or well over 100 megabytes a second. That data for that VHD is being transferred on that back-end storage network. And we can look at the CPU utilization and see that it is very small. Not using much of my CPU at all. Not using my CPU to transfer data up into that server and then transfer data back down into the other array. And also here we can see, now we see that the file has been transferred across from one to the other. We can also see thin provisioning. So here I'm using the storage management built into Windows to go to these two arrays, or excuse me, to the array hosting the H drive and look at its utilization. So the key thing to look at here is that we only have 408 gigabytes capacity remaining. Now I'll just go off and delete that file. And now NTFS has gotten the file deletion. It's generated the unmap command. It's sent that unmap command down the stack. It's been translated as it goes through the various layers down to the disk, and it's been delivered to the storage subsystem. It's able to use that unmap command to remove capacity from that disk and give it back to the storage pool. So as we come back here, perform that same inspection, we should see that the storage subsystem has already had the opportunity to take that capacity and add it back in. So when I had that VHD there, I only had 408 gigabytes remaining. After I deleted it, My pool then got that capacity back, 415 gigabytes. That's just integrated into Windows. When you have a storage subsystem which has been updated to latest standards, that's just something you get at no additional work. Now, the very nice thing about offloaded data transfers is it's been plumbed through the entire stack, all the way up into VHDs. So it works on local volumes, over SMB, on remote file shares. You can just locally mount a VHD and delete files inside of it, or you can even have your VHD mounted to your virtual machine, have your workload deleting files or deleting sections of files, and have that that unmap command transferred all the way down, as well as offloaded data transfers. It can, inside your VMs, you can also copy the files across and just get these benefits. Offloading transfers to the storage array, returning capacity back to the storage arrays. Here's a diagram of what we just did. Despite the long distance connection, low throughput connection, we are moving over 100 megabytes a second. So offloaded data transfer, as I described, this is a standard that we drove with the industry standard body, and so it needs updated firmware, updated to your storage arrays. And here is a short list of a few of the partners which are already working on updating their storage subsystems to the latest standard to support ODX. And ODX is a very compelling feature, the offloading data transfers, and so I am sure that this list will continue to grow. So the message I would like for you to take away from this is Windows Server 2012 has made managing your storage systems easier by giving you one roof of management, has made data transfers efficient, and has made capacity utilization, achieving high levels of capacity utilization, even easier than has been possible until now. So to recap, here is an overview in a nutshell view of what we have done for enterprise storage in Windows Server 2012. We've enabled that new category of storage, directly attached storage, and we've given more capabilities for storage subsystems and given them the ability to better integrate with Windows. With all of these enhancements, we think we've made Windows Server 2012 the most cost-efficient platform for high availability and high scalability. So I appreciate you coming to the breakout session today. I hope you found it useful. There are other breakout sessions which are related and useful. If you haven't been able to see them, if you weren't able to attend them, you can go back and view their videos and learn from them as well. If you'd like to talk to me, I'll be here. I have some pamphlets up front that give you a very simple way to get started with storage spaces. If you don't catch up with me here, tomorrow I'll be at the Technical Learning Center at the Windows Storage booth. You can catch me there. And there you can actually see the hardware I've used for the storage spaces demos today. That's one more slide I need to leave this on. There we go. So again, thank you for coming, and have a good week at TechEd.